I am Taylor Hollis. I live in upstate New York. When I volunteered to be the chair of Todd's session here, Todd didn't know who I was. But I met him at the Mormon History Association in Sacramento. So anyway, the title of his presentation is Mitt Romney's Polygamous Heritage. In 1982, Todd completed his master's degree from Brigham Young University. He later received a PhD from UCLA in classics. Todd began his serious work in Mormon history as a visiting fellow at the Huntington Library studying the journals of Liza R. Snow. While researching Snow's journals, Compton found that he needed a good list of Joseph Smith's plural wives. The best list available at that time was an appendix by Fawn Brody. And Todd felt that this list had lots of problems. It was inflated. It depended too much on anti-Mormon writing. So he began researching on his own, which eventually grew into his 1997 book, In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith. Todd received the Best Book Award for this book from the Mormon History Association and the Best Book Award from the John Whitmer Historical Association. Todd is an independent researcher and is currently working on a biography of Indian missionary Jacob Hamblin. I first heard of Todd Compton in 1999 when I was visiting my sister in Ogden, Utah. It was this year the Mormon History Association meetings were held in Ogden. My sister and her husband knew Todd in Peru as Todd's father, who is here at a meeting today, was a Spanish professor at BYU, went there to do research on a Peruvian writer. My sister said they were going for one day to the MHA to hear Todd's presentation, and would I like to go? Well, of course. I'd only been to MHA once before when it was held in New York in 1980. And I enjoyed that session, so sure. So we went down to hear Todd speak. And my memory of the session was that one of the reviewers thought his book, In Sacred Loneliness, would be an aid to the anti-Mormons. The reviewer criticized him, but not the content of his book, as I remember right. I like Todd's statement in front of his book, which says, "To my parents who gave me ideals of faith and honesty." Isn't that a wonderful statement? "To my parents who gave me ideals of faith and honesty." Todd is a meticulous researcher, and I think he's gained prestige among Mormon historians. I'm not really a historian, but I try to be. So now we'll hear about Mitt Romney's polygamous heritage. And there was a chart handed out. Everybody get one? Raise your hand if you didn't get one.
A couple more here.
That's all we got.
There's a couple more back there, too.
Okay, welcome to the middle of nowhere. You need to be commended for being here this early in the morning.
That was the hardest part.
And I'll dive into the paper. In summer 1885, Miles Park Romney's great-grandfather, wearing a disguise, boarded a train in Salt Lake City with his wife, Annie Woodbury Romney, and her three young children. He may have sat apart from them to preserve his incognito. They traveled to San Francisco, then east through California and into Arizona. At the San Simon Railway Station in southeastern Arizona, near the New Mexico border, Will and Miles Archibald Romney, two of Miles Park's older sons, met their father and Annie with a team and wagon, which would transport them to Mormon settlements that were just beginning in Mexico. Why was Miles Clark moving to Mexico? Annie was his fourth wife. Will was the son of his second wife, Carrie, and Miles Archibald was the son of his first wife, Hannah. Earlier in the year, Miles had left his home in St. John's in eastern Arizona to escape federal marshals who sought to arrest him and his wives on charges of unlawful cohabitation, polygamy. Therefore, he, quote, was advised by the presidency of the LDS Church to flee to Old Mexico for safety, quote, according to a family history. Church leaders knew that Miles was a prominent target for U.S. Marshals. As Romney crossed the U.S.-Mexican border, he must have pondered this momentous step he was taking. Mormons were usually proud Americans and often told of their ancestors fighting in the Revolutionary War. But as the result of intense legal harassment in the 1880s, which Mormons regarded as straightforward religious persecution, many saints, including Miles Clark, and eventually all of his five wives, except for one wife who had separated from him, would leave America and face uncertain prospects in a foreign land. This choice shows their profound commitment to their faith, its leaders, and its most peculiar and controversial practice, plural marriage. But Mormons such as Mitt Romney are now viewed as thoroughly in the conservative political mainstream of America. His forefathers and mothers were, just a few generations back, sacrificing much to perpetuate a non-standard marriage system, polygamy, that they believed was commanded by God and that was illegal and often necessarily practiced in secret. Their life histories offer a revealing cross-section of the principle, showing what it meant to live in plurality in 19th century Nauvoo, Utah, Arizona, and Mexico. And two themes that jumped out at me as I was doing this research. One is the fact that how many of his ancestors entered polygamy when they were directly asked or commanded to do so by a church presence. And another thing that jumped out at me was the principle of theocratic ethics, what historian D. Michael Quinn calls theocratic ethics, in which you know, if a command of God conflicts with the command of a secular governmental command, you obey the command from God, from the prophet. And the whole history of polygamy kind of exemplifies theocratic ethics, since polygamy was just about always illegal. Okay, this paper is on my website, and I have the address at the bottom here. So I'm getting a compressed form today. You can go home and read the whole thing. And I kind of wrote it for non-Mormons, so there's a lot about the basic history of polygamy in here. And I'm leaving all that out. I'm assuming you all know everything. Okay, so we'll start with Parley P. Pratt, who's in the great-great-grandfather level of his ancestors. And he began to practice plural marriage during one of the earliest periods of Mormon history. Pratt was one of the most dynamic and brilliant leaders in early Mormonism. He left a beautifully written autobiography and many skillfully argued religious tracts. He lived the standard, amazingly eventful life of early Mormon leaders, including numerous stateside and international missions and exploring and colonizing expeditions in the far west. On September 9, 1844, the 37-year-old Pratt married 26-year-old Mary Wood in Nauvoo as his second plural wife. They would have four children, and Mitt Romney is a descendant of this union. And strangely enough, John Huntsman, who competed with Mitt for the Republican nomination, is also a descendant of Parley P. Pratt, but from a different wife, Belinda Martin. And Pratt had a family of 12 wives in all and 30 kids. Okay, and since Parley P. Pratt is well known, I'm summarizing a lot about him. So he had kind of a tumultuous family life. He was hard-pressed to support all of his wives and his kids since he was often gone on missions. And his family often lived in poverty. This comes out pretty clearly in the new biography of Parley P. Pratt. by Gibbons and Guerrero, I think he is.
Yes.
Yeah. And, many of them loved Spurwise, loved him, at least one divorced him, but those who stayed loved him. He was very charismatic. One of his wives was named Belinda Martin, and she wrote one of the earliest polygamy defenses. And she describes the Pratt family life like this in glowing terms. "I have a good and virtuous husband whom I love. We have four little children, which are mutually and inexpressibly dear to us. And besides this, my husband has seven other living wives, and one who has departed to a better world. He has in all upwards of 25 children. All these mothers and children are endeared to me by kindred ties, by mutual affection, by acquaintance and association, and mothers in particular by mutual and long-continued exercises of toil, patience, long-suffering, and sisterly kindness. We all have our imperfections in this life, but I know that these are good and worthy women, and that my husband is a good and worthy man, one who keeps the commandments of Jesus Christ and presides in his family like an Abraham." And in her polygamy defense, she looked at the examples of the patriarchs in the Old Testament. "He seeks to provide for them with all diligence. He loves them all and seeks to comfort them and make them happy. He teaches them the commandments of Jesus Christ and gathers them about in the family circle to call upon God both morning and evening." And she was writing this in a letter to her sister, and she ended, "Dear sister, do not let your prejudices and traditions keep you from believing the Bible. Nor pride, shame, or love of the world keep you from your seat in the kingdom of heaven among the royal family of polygamists."
Todd, what year is that?
What was it? 1854. Okay. So Mitt Romney's great-grandmother, Mary Wood, was, like Belinda, was also a well-educated young woman and accomplished seamstress. She had converted to Mormonism in England and became good friends with Harley and his functioning first wife at the time, Mary Ann Frost, as they served a mission there. Mary Wood came to Nauvoo in March 1844, and half a year later, on September 9th, she joined the Pratt family as a plural wife. In 1846, as the Mormons left Nauvoo, she started crossing Iowa while pregnant, and on March 22nd, about an hour from Mount Pisgah, a Mormon way station that had been founded and named it by Harley B. Pratt, she asked for her wagon to stop. She bore her first child, Helaman Pratt, Mitt Romney's great-grandfather, there. And half an hour later, she and the baby were on the way west again. Okay. As you probably know, as is well known, polygamy was a factor in Harley B. Pratt's untimely death at the age of 50. So his last wife, Eleanor McLean, had married a non-Mormon, Hector McLean, in San Francisco, near where I live. And his heavy drinking and abusive, violent nature put severe strains on the marriage. And eventually she left him, but the children went down to New Orleans. Her husband sent the three children, to New Orleans to live with her parents in New Orleans, because he didn't want the children to stay with her. So she married Harley P. Pratt as his last wife in Salt Lake City. And then she and Harley went to try to get the kids. And when Hector McLean found out about this, he decided he wanted to kill Harley P. Pratt. And he hunted him down and shot him, killed him. And he had the law enforcement of the area helping to track him down. He had kind of filed a couple of bogus lawsuits against Harley B. Pratt for stealing the clothes on the backs of the children. You know, but they brought him to this trial, and the judge released him for lack of good evidence. But soon after he was released, McLean was able to track him down and kill him. Okay. Starting in about 1847, Mormons lived a period that I call practical polygamy, when plurality was lived openly. And this lasted to the early 1880s. And during Nauvoo, polygamy was very secret, Sub Rosa. But starting around 1847, within the Mormon community, polygamy was lived openly. And many of Mitt Romney's ancestors ended in polygamy during this period. His great-great-grandfather, Archibald Hill, who's on my chart here, had five wives. Hill was born in Scotland, but his parents moved to Canada when he was a boy. A carpenter and farmer, he married the Canadian-born Isabella Good, Mitt Romney's great-great-grandmother, in 1840. They had three children, one of whom, Hannah Good Hill, would marry Miles Park Romney. After converting to Mormonism the same year, they came to Nauvoo in 1843. Archibald, like Miles Romney, helped build the Nauvoo Temple. And I skipped over Miles Romney just a little bit because he was a monogamist in the interest of time. But he was a very fine carpenter, and he ended up in St. George and helped build the St. George Temple and St. George Tabernacle. And people even now point out the beautiful staircase he built in Tabernacle. Okay, but now we're talking about Archibald Hill. He, like Miles Romney, helped build the Nauvoo Temple. In 1847, Isabella died in winter quarters near the Missouri River while she and Archibald were preparing to cross the plains to Utah. Archibald placed his three children with relatives and moved to Utah. Hannah was taken in by her aunt and uncle, William Swap and Elizabeth Hill Swap, who brought her to Salt Lake City when she was 6 years of age. Hill became a successful businessman in Utah, worked at the church co-op store, ZCMI, and oversaw the LDS tithing office for 14 years. He married Elizabeth Margaret Fotheringham, married Milam, his first plural wife, in 1853, and they later divorced, as you'll see, and Caroline Graham. 15 years later, in 1872, he married Mary House. In the story of Carly P. Pratt's death, the non-Mormon legal husband of a wife killed a man who had married his wife in polygamous marriage. In the family history of Archibald Hill, there is a curious inverse mirror image of that event, in which I've been leaving out all the pictures. That's the best part. Well, there's Carly P. Pratt and Belinda Martin, who wrote that polygamy defense. And there's Mitt Romney's actual ancestor, Mary Wood Pratt. Mary Ann Frost was in the longer paper. There's a kind of a long story about her. And there's Parley's last wife, Eleanor Jane McLean Pratt. And there's Miles and Elizabeth Gaskell Romney. He's the carpenter in St. George, non-polygamous. Oh, there's a staircase, okay, in St. George. Okay, now we're to Archibald Hill. Okay. And in his story, we have a non-Mormon marrying one of Hill's plural wives, who's this Mary Emma, in a civil marriage, and then the non-Mormon was murdered as a result. Mary Emma had married Archibald on December 20th, 1853, a few days before her 16th birthday, and he was 37. Marriage to young teens was more common in polygamous culture than in monogamous society because plural marriage caused increased competition for wives, which caused the marriage age of women to lower. The marriage was not too stable, as Mary left Hill to live with a non-Mormon for a short time, but she returned to Hill, and they had two children. About a decade later, on March 28, 1866, when Archibald was on a mission to England, Mary Emma left Hill's household again and married a non-Mormon named Squire Newton Brassfield, a freighter who had become wealthy during the silver boom in Austin, Nevada. And Brassfield, according to some reports, had deserted a wife in Kansas when he came to Nevada. This marriage was civil, performed by a non-Mormon judge. Mary Emma and Brassfield sought to take her children and possessions from Hill's household one night, but his family and friends, there's another parallel with the Pratt story, isn't it? So the children were an important issue. But Archibald's family and friends called the police to prevent them. The Mormon community was furious that a non-Mormon had married a woman while her polygamous husband was overseas. Brasfield allegedly drew a weapon on the police during the confrontation. And Miles P. Roney, Miles Park, Hill's son-in-law, brought suit against Brasfield on the charge of resisting arrest. In court, Brasfield was released on bail and tried a few days later. This indictment was quashed. Roney then brought suit against Brasfield on the charge of larceny. On April 2nd, after a long day in court, Brasfield was returning to his hotel accompanied by a U.S. Marshal when an unknown assailant suddenly opened fire, shooting him 5 times, then running and escaping into the dark back streets of Salt Lake City. And Brasfield died soon thereafter. This murder, like the killing of Carly P. Pratt, shows the social and legal difficulty of living in a culture, territorial Utah, in which two different marriage systems were operating. Sometimes they could be combined, as when a first wife was also a legal wife, but at other times each type of matrimony seemed to negate the opposing system ideologically. In addition, this conflict resulted from a common pattern in the history of polygamy. Young teenage wives, when they married older men, sometimes did not bond emotionally with them, and divorces resulted. The murders of Carly P. Pratt and Newton Brasfield obviously deserve more extended examination than can be given here. If we try to look at these incidents through the lens of 21st century morality, they have a Rashomon-like quality, especially as we look at contemporary pro-Mormon and anti-Mormon journalistic treatments of the events. Both murders seem reprehensible to us. Both were consistent with cultural assumptions of the 19th century South and West. And there's a really good article on the Mormon aspect of that. Kenneth Cannon, Mountain Common Law, the Extra-Legal Punishment of Seducers in Early Utah. But I recommend. Mary Emma retreated to Fort Douglas for protection, was able to gain custody of her children, and left Utah for Austin, Nevada. There she remained. Another great-grandfather, Mitt Romney, was German-born Carl Heinrich, Americanized to Charles Henry Wilkin, whose name was preserved in Mitt's father's full name, George Wilkin Romney. Charles Wilkin stands out as a colorful character even in the very roster of Mitt Romney's ancestors. As a young man of large stature, he fought for Prussia against Denmark, and the Prussian king gave him the Iron Cross for valor after the war. Instead of following a military career in Europe, Carl Heinrich decided to go look for a brother who had come to South America. But he kept missing the South American boat and ended up in England, then in New York City. Here, running short of cash, he joined Johnston's army and marched west to subdue the Mormons in the Utah War of 1857. On October 7th, however, Charles Henry, disgusted with the lax military discipline, deserted from the U.S. Army and turned himself over to the Saints. He became a prisoner of the legendary Mormon enforcer, Orrin Porter Rockwell. But Charles apparently didn't offend Port, for he survived and was baptized a Mormon 2 months later. After this somewhat surreal series of abrupt changes in cultural context, he cast his lot with the Mormons for the rest of his life. What a background, even before he became a Mormon. Wilkin served in the Mormon military, worked for CCMI as a watermaster and a miller. He became a close friend of many church leaders and served as a trusted go-between bodyguard and messenger for church presidents John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff, and First Presidency Counselor George Q. Cannon when they were hiding during the federal raids on polygamists in the 1880s. Wilkin's friendship with Cannon was so strong that he was sealed to him as an adopted son. Charles Henry himself became a polygamist, wedding 4 wives. And I'm going to summarize a little bit here. One of the most interesting wives was Heidi Verena Carlisle, daughter of English converts who settled in Mill Creek in South Salt Lake City. And church leaders on the underground often hid in the Carlisle home. And Charles Henry and Heidi had 6 children from 1889 to 1905. of whom three lived to maturity. Unfortunately, Charles Henry did not support Heidi and her family consistently, and in 1899 required them to live near Abraham Millard County in west central Utah, 5 miles west of Delta. Heidi was extremely isolated in Abraham with little female companionship, and Charles Henry visited only infrequently. He sold the ranch in Abraham in 1903, and Heidi and her children moved back to Salt Lake City. Living in the same... Let's see what's coming up here.
Well, that's the... Okay.
Living in the same house with his first wife, Eliza, who was from Germany, did not work out, and Heidi asked Charles to build them a house on the property her father had left her in Mill Creek. He replied, "No, there is a home in Abraham if you want it." According to a family history, as much as Heidi dreaded going back to Abraham, she made the choice. Charles went to Abraham with them to help them move and get located. The house they moved into was the Harris home in the town. Charles stayed to see that they were settled, then left and never returned. Some polygamous marriages never seem to crystallize into full relationships, and this may have been one of them. The 30-year age difference between Charles and Heidi may have been a factor. Or, after 1890, living as a polygamist became increasingly difficult, and Charles may have felt that open cohabitation would subject him to legal peril. Despite Charles Henry's absence, Heidi never formally divorced him. The name on her gravestone in Delta is Heidi B. Wilkin. Okay, so in the 1880s, we had this intense period of religious, political, legal persecution of Mormons for polygamy, and many Mormon leaders served terms in jail. And George Buchanan, the first presidency, did this, and Charles Wilkin drove him to the penitentiary, visited him every day, and took him away from the penitentiary. So he was a firsthand witness of what was going on in this period. Archibald Newell Hill also served a term in prison for unlawful cohabitation in 1888. Rutger Clausen, and there were a number of pieces of legislation, one of which was the Edmunds Act. The first Mormon sentenced under this was Rutger Clausen, who later became an apostle. And he gave kind of a classic statement of theocratic ethics. He said when he was sentenced, "I very much regret that the laws of my country should come in conflict with the laws of God. But whenever they do, I shall invariably choose the latter." So he became a folk hero among Mormons, was an apostle, and took a plural wife on August 3rd, 1904, long after polygamy had been officially abandoned by the Mormon Church. And the contemporary newspapers, Deseret Evening News, were very outspoken about this legal persecution. They called the Edmunds-Tucker Act the infamy, the Edmunds-Tucker subjugation infamy, or the anti-Mormon law. So we move on now to the next level of Mitt's ancestors, which this is all on his father's side, by the way. So the Miles Park Romney level, their great-grandparents in the Romney. Okay. So they're a generation that began in open polygamy in Utah that ended in a period of secret and exiled polygamy that followed the church's public official renunciation of polygamy in 1890. So Miles Park Romney had been born in Nauvoo to Miles and Elizabeth. Like his father, he followed the trade of carpenter. He was a gifted orator and writer and loved drama. He served in a number of bishoprics, both as bishop and counselor. A family history tells us how and why Miles Park entered polygamy. Already married to a first wife, Hannah Hood Hill, since 1862, he returned from a British mission, and that's Hannah Hood is Mitt's direct ancestor. He returned from a British mission and built a home in Salt Lake City. Quote, "And he scarcely completed it when he took a second wife at the request of President Brigham Young." Oh, and in my summaries, I should have mentioned Harley P. Pratt in Nauvoo, when J. Joseph Smith was introducing polygamy to a lot of his reluctant inner group of disciples, he commanded Parley P. Pratt to take a plural wife, and Parley was reluctant, and his wife, Mary Ann Frost, at the time was reluctant, and Joseph Smith even picked out his wife for him. So it wasn't, that fits in with this pattern of the prophet picking, you know, instructing someone to take a plural wife. In Joseph Smith's case, he even picked out the wife. This marriage with Caroline Lamborn, a beautiful young woman born in England, was solemnized on March 23, 1867. And a family history takes the trouble to show the religious motivation for the marriage. Nothing short of a firm belief in the divine origin of the revelation of plural marriage could have induced Miles P. Romney to take a second wife. And certain it is that Hannah would never have permitted such a heartbreaking thing to come into her life had it not been for the testimony she had of the divinity of the mission of Prophet Joseph Smith. This was no doubt the greatest trial that had ever come into her life, for her love for her husband knew no bounds. End quote. Miles Parkin's family were called to settle in St. George in southern Utah in 1867. The marriage to Caroline Lamborn did not last. According to a family history, quote, the trials incident to plural marriage proved to be too great for Carrie, and after she had given birth to two children, she left her husband and returned to Salt Lake City to make her home. End quote. There she remarried. Miles Park next, in 1873, wedded Catherine Jane Cottom, daughter of English converts who had settled in St. George. And Hannah wrote movingly of Catherine's entrance into the family. Miles Park and Catherine had traveled to Salt Lake City to solemnize the plural marriage. While they were gone, Hannah worked hard to prepare a pleasant home and room for the new wife.
Yep. Okay, there's Miles Park and his first wife, Hannah Hood. Yeah, there's a nice family portrait of the whole family there. Okay.
Okay, and Hannah worked hard to prepare a pleasant home and room for the new plural wife. I worked hard all day and part of the night, she wrote. I had a room finished for Catherine with new carpet and furniture all ready for her. I cannot explain how I suffered in my feelings while I was doing all this hard work, but I felt that I would do my duty if my heart did ache. I had such a hard time with his other wife that I feared I would have the same kind of trial again. But when I came to live with Sister Catherine, it was quite different. She was considerate of my feelings and good to the children. End quote. Miles Park married his fourth wife, Annie Maria Woodbury, in 1877. A gifted teacher, she moved into the large white house in St. George that sheltered the entire Romney family. You latecomers, there's a... there's a handout. There might be some over there. I don't know. Okay, the Miles Park family was sent to Arizona, the Little Colorado Mission, and Miles Park became a newspaper editor who was a strong supporter of the Mormon position and attacker of anti-Mormon positions, and so he became a target. And even his wives had to escape from federal marshals every now and then. And so faced with widespread legal prosecution of polygamists in Utah and Arizona, LDS Church President John Taylor sent Mormons to found colonies in Mexico.
Where did I have that? Okay.
The purpose of these colonies was to allow the saints to practice plural marriage without prosecution by United States officers. They were sanctuaries for polygamists. As we have seen, in 1885, Miles Park moved to the colonies with Annie. It was a significant symbolic event. He and his family were giving up all the benefits and advantages of American culture and government so that they could live polygamy in peace. Though the Mormons went down there and they kind of made a little Utah community way down there in Mexico. You go down and visit those places and they kind of look like, even the architecture is Utah architecture. It's fascinating. Okay, a year later, Miles sent for his first wife, Hannah, to join him
Her trip to Mexico through Apache country in Arizona with only teenage sons to accompany her became part of family legend. Raiding Apaches, such as Geronimo, were still a serious danger. At one point, 17-year-old Miles Archibald Romney and 15-year-old Gaskell Romney, who's on my chart here, he's the grandfather of Mitt Romney, came upon a party of whites who had been slaughtered by Indians days before. They calmly removed the shoes from the dead horses, put them on their own horses, and continued their journey. Hannah and her children made it to Mexico safely. After another year, Catherine Cottom and her family were able to travel to Mexico. Okay, in the interest of time, we're going to have to leave a lot out here, but the Miles Park family did well. They had a hard time at first in Mexico. They were pioneers all over again. Okay, but they eventually did well. Miles Park was a fine carpenter. These boys were hard workers. Miles Park's last wife was Emily Henrietta Iron Snow, a widow, whom he married in 1897. Though Miles Park generally treated his wives equally, both in his affections and in economic matters, according to family traditions, the previous wives of Miles Park reportedly resented his attentions to Millie. It was a common pattern in Mormon polygamy for a younger wife to become a favored wife, causing tensions with the previous wives. Miles Park had 30 children with his five wives.
What does the map show?
These are the colonies in Mexico. But I think,
is it a trip or did they move? I don't know. Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
That's a good question. I think the only two colonies that are in existence now are Colonia Juarez and Colonia Dublon. Is that correct? I believe they're the only ones that survived. Okay, so I'm going to have to wrap this up. I'll summarize Helam and Pratt. So he married two of the daughters of Charles Henry and Eliza C.C. Vica. And so we have really interesting traditions from both of those wives. According to family traditions, he did this on the advice of Brigham Young. So once again, his dad, the prophet, instructed him to take a plural wife, so he did. There's Helam and Pratt. He's kind of a hero of mine because he had dealings with Jacob Hamlin. So he was one of the great missionaries into Mexico. That's his first wife. Now, there's a wonderful website, I think called the Jared Pratt website, and it has a lot of these pictures, a lot of histories of his family. And so this is Dora Wilkin Pratt, and so this is his second wife. And then in 1898, he married Bertha. And both, look at their faces. This is how photographs are wonderful historical records. Look at that set look of determination on Dora's face as a younger woman. And then look at her sister, that same look of determination there. And Bertha was a school teacher, a very fine school teacher. And here she is in the LDS college. And it's very interesting to see her, the one woman seated here with all these young men. I believe the LDS College is the ancestor of the LDS Business College. And so the Helam and Pratt family ended up in Utah, and Bertha and Dora lived together in the same house. They had a very easy, sometimes even sisters had a hard time getting along in the plural marriage, but they got along with each other quite well. And according to family traditions, the Helam and Pratt family was very, quite unified. I write this. Pratt's plural family dynamics present a striking contrast to his father's tumultuous extended plural family life. Helam limited his family to three wives, and he apparently took his plural wives with the full consent of his first wife. He consulted with the first wife, which probably P. Pratt hadn't done. That's some of what I had to leave out. Okay, so all of this history of polygamy, it's a very interesting, for me, contrast with the modern LDS church. From this colorful background, full of non-standard marriages carried out in defiance of the U.S. government, comes the man who hopes to become the standard bearer, who is the standard bearer for the super conservative Republican Party, which is veering ever farther to the right, in my personal view. The political rise of George and Mitt Romney is an improbable story in one sense. In another sense, it is typical of the transformation of Mormonism from a 19th century, quote, countercultural church, you know, which defied the U.S. government and its legal system throughout the 19th century, to a 20th and 21st century church that has aspired to transform itself into a quintessentially normal American organization. And one of the reasons I got interested in this story, one was I've always been interested in the history of polygamy and in post-manifesto polygamy and in Mexico. And by the way, both Hewlin Pratt and Miles Park's last wives were post-manifesto, post-1890. And I found some misinformation on the internet that I wanted to straighten out and work out. So that's one of the reasons I got interested. But also I was interested because I and my wife are interested in the gay marriage controversy in recent years. And at one point, Romney, talking about this issue of non-standard marriage, said, quote, "There was a long time ago a state that considered the practice of polygamy legal. And as I recall, the federal government correctly stepped in and said, this is not something the state should decide." So isn't that amazing? Mitt Romney is saying that these, you know, the federal government, the federal marshals, which the Mormons just hate and despise, and which, you know, his ancestors left America to get away from, he's saying they were right. So I think that's emblematic of the change in our church from last century to this century. Thank you.
Oh, you're the commentator. Oh, I didn't realize you were a commentator.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll go sit down.
Grab my glasses.
Oh, Craig.
Hi, my name is Craig Foster, and I was asked to comment on Todd's paper. And I want to start out by saying I thoroughly enjoyed reading this. It was just a lot of fun reading, very interesting. Todd Compton's Plural Lives, Mitt Romney's Polygamous Heritage, is a well-documented, what I feel is a preliminary analysis, at least hopefully I can twist Todd's arm, of Mitt Romney's polygamous ancestors. Like Todd's other works, it is well-researched and filled with interesting information. But the paper at this point has left me with a number of questions that I would like to have answered. And the first one he answered for me, which is, you know, I wondered if this was part of a larger study, if this was aimed for a larger audience. Which leads into a discussion of plural marriage and the early saints being commanded to practice the principle. While discussing the emphasis placed on obeying the prophet, Todd wrote, "Such a believer could not disobey the prophet, who was viewed as receiving inspiration directly from God, and remain in good standing." As with pretty much everything else in life, that was not always the case. Most of the men in leadership were asked to take plural wives, and most indeed did take plural wives. But there are some examples of men in positions of prominence who were asked or had suggested to them that they enter into the principle, and they chose not to, but still remained in leadership positions. Off the top of my head, I thought of two individuals. One was David McKay, Bishop of Huntsville and father of future church president David O. McKay, who was repeatedly asked to enter into plural marriage and refused to do so. Also, John T. King, who served in territorial positions and was 8 years in the United States House of Representatives, did not marry plurally. Thus, while most 19th century Mormons and ecclesiastical and other leadership were polygamous, some were not. I was left with several questions regarding the unfortunate marriage between Archibald Ann Hill and Mary Emma Milam. It's mentioned that marriage to young teens was more common in polygamous culture than in monogamous society because of increased competition. While that might generally be true, I was at a loss as to what might have caused increased competition for wives in December of 1853, and perhaps someone like Mike Quinn could probably help out here, but I could not think of a great competition at that time, since this was between two periods of competition or increased plural marriages. The public announcement of plural marriage in August of 52, and then, of course, the Mormon Reformation. I think the dynamics between monogamous marriage and polygamous marriages that Todd alluded to was quite interesting. I really thought that was interesting. Would love to see Todd flesh that out a little bit more. Obviously, the killing of Brasfield was a horrible tragedy and certainly was murder. But was his killing a result of the friction between these two marriage systems, or was it a reflection, as Todd points out, of the 19th century cultural trend? There was a cultural acceptance of the idea, quote, the libertine must die, as described in a number of works regarding the code of honor, that to bring shame to a female member of the family, such as a wife or daughter, was punishable through extra-legal violence, even up to death. Robert M. Ireland, in The Libertine Must Die, Sexual Dishonor and the Unwritten Law in the 19th Century United States, explained, quote, during the 19th century, American juries came to recognize an unwritten law that an outraged husband, father, or brother could justifiably kill the alleged libertine who had been sexually intimate with the defendant's wife, daughter, or sister. And such views were not only held in Mormon Utah and back hills of Tennessee, but were found in New York, Illinois, and other parts of the country and were accepted as a way of deterring sexual deviance. In fact, to many during this time period, it was not only accepted, it was expected that a male member would avenge sexual liberties against a female member of their family. And this situation would have been considered something on par with that. I also question how common of a pattern was it really for a teenage polygamous wife to not bond with her older husband. Was it more or less common than a young teenage monogamous wife to not bond with her husband? And are there works available that discuss this? That's what I am trying to get to. I would love to see that fleshed out a little bit more to see if there are some statistics like regarding divorce rates of teenage brides compared to those who are older here in Utah. Some of these same questions came up again during the discussion of the marriage of Charles Henry Wilkin and Heidi Verena Carlisle. It most certainly was an unhappy marriage. Perhaps it was the 30-year age difference, or maybe it wasn't. I'm not sure. We don't know because there wasn't any evidence either way, and I'd love to see if there's more evidence in terms of journals or letters, something along that line. Does this unfortunate marriage example, let's see, we don't know, does this unfortunate marriage, for example, since Romney didn't descend from Heidi, does it relate to the dynamics of some of the other members of the family? Again, I'm not sure. I am, however, reminded of my own great-grandparents. My great-grandfather, grandmother, was the fifth wife and was almost 38 years younger than my great-grandfather. It was a difficult marriage because of the raid, but they loved each other, and she never married after his death when she was only 43 and did have opportunity to do so. So you can see contrast both ways, and you could write a whole paper there. So I keep saying I'd love to see more. I realize you don't want to make this into a book, but this leads me to another question regarding the timing of said events. There are children who were born between 1889 and 1905, which was definitely after the time of the raid. And yet it is suggested in the paper that after 1890, living as a polygamist became increasingly difficult. I would be interested to see what Carmen Hardy and Mike Quinn have to say about that, because with my own research and my own studies, I have found that the period between 1890 and 1904, for the most part, was a rather calm period in terms of legal ramifications for cohabiting with wives married previously to the manifesto. In other words, law officials, for the most part, were not as zealous as they had been previous to the manifesto. I know in our own family, again, using my great-grandfather as an example, my great-grandfather was arrested and my great-grandmother was subpoenaed in 1892, shortly after my grandmother's birth. And they were pulled into court for unlawful cohabitation. The judge threw the case out, basically saying in so many words that he didn't have time for stuff like that. And so, as I said, it did not seem to be a difficult period at that time. There was some great information on the Romney marriages, but again, I was left to question some of the assumptions regarding Miles Park Romney's marriage to Emily Millie Henrietta Irene Snow, half-sister of Edward Christian Irene and widow of William Spencer Snow, the son of Erastus Snow. Yes, I'm bringing in my genealogy. You know, the passion, what can I say? It's mentioned that the other wives resented Miles' attentions to Millie, and yet we do not see any documented evidence of this and why. And I'd love to see that to try to fill it out a little bit more. Running out of time. And this jumped out at me, and I might be completely wrong on this, but could it very well have been that her background was so different from the other wives? While all five wives were born in Canada or the United States, the four wives, first four wives, were from English or Manx background, while Millie's ancestral heritage was German, Swiss, and Italian. So, that was a, kind of a question that I had. Was it also cultural that there might have been some differences? I realize there are examples in Mormon history of the younger wife being the favorite. I also realize that the idea of the younger, prettier wife being the favorite is a favorite stereotypical image that was used by critics of the church and even those within the church. In fact, in my own family, we, as descendants of the fifth wife, always refer to her as the pretty young wife. And if anyone saw photos of the first wife, they might agree with us. But but the irony is that the first wife was the favored wife in my great-grandfather's family. And I don't think that was alone from some things that I've read, that sometimes the first wife was the favorite. So there were differences there. Ultimately, this journey through Mitt Romney's polygamous ancestors has been interesting and informative, but the most important part of the journey is to know how all of this has affected Mitt Romney. Were some of these polygamous ancestors of more interest and influence for Romney than others, and if so, why? There have been a number of things said about this. I would love to see the characters rounded out a little bit more, become more multi-dimensional characters, and it fleshed out a little bit. So basically, Todd did a very good job of demonstrating Mitt Romney's ambivalence, if not outright dislike of his polygamous heritage. I love the quote that you gave when he testified before Congress. I was surprised that you didn't give the quote. Excuse me, from 60 Minutes, when he said, "I can't imagine anything more awful than polygamy." And I would love to know, why does he feel so strongly about this? And I don't know if you can find out that. But this is a great beginning, and I had already said beforehand that I sure hope that you flesh this out more. because it's a fascinating subject, and I think it will help us give insight into Almi's heritage and worldview.
Give a few minutes to Todd to respond.
Let's see, I should have taken notes. I searched for a pen in my pocket,
but it's my dad's pocket. So. just a couple things. Some of the things I talk about in here are patterns. That doesn't mean it happened in every case. So you find examples of polygamous wives who were very young when they married older husbands, and the marriage worked out really well. But you do find other situations where it didn't work out. So some of the examples I mentioned in here were in that other pattern. What else? Darn, there are a couple things I said. I've got to talk about this. And I can't. You know, they're not coming to my mind right now. So anyway, let's turn the time over to you.
Yeah. Yes. Why don't you stay there and answer questions?
Okay. Joe?
Yeah, Todd. Thank you very much for the paper. That's a great paper. As I said before, your compassion towards these pioneers is striking to me. On Lenore Lafont, George Romney's wife, was there a polygamous heritage there? Have you done any research on that side?
Okay, go down to the very bottom of the handout. Okay, and
Oh, yeah, right there.
Mother's, okay.
She's
done a really nice
view.
But she looks at both sides, the mother's side, the fountain, and the stuff I looked at also.
Is it pretty pervasive in that side?
Not pervasive, but there are a couple examples.
Okay.
Some interesting stories.
Yeah.
And I thought, I just need to keep
right.
it
you have
to
just,
one
right.
side. And I was mainly interested in the polygamy in Mexico,
right.
post-manifesto polygamy.
Thank you.
But there's some interesting stories on that other side, so I recommend that that little post by Ann Theriot.
Yeah. While that picture is still up there, I want to draw people's attention to the person sitting just to the left of Bertha. That would be to our right. Levi Edgar Young. And he was a member of the First Council of 70. I'm particularly interested because I interviewed him when I was doing my master's thesis on Maud May Babcock, and I just wanted to call attention to that little piece of history. There are people in the room who I'm sure remember Levi Edgar Young.
Yes.
This
gentleman pointed out Levi Edgar Young seated next to Bertha Wilcox, and I always love to see pictures of General Authorities when they were young whippersnappers. You know, because often we think of General Authorities as very old men. And it's fun to see them. They were young people like us.
I was wondering if you have any idea about, like, George Romney's ideas of polygamy, and did get the, you know, the disdain that he seems to publicly be talking about for polygamy from George or his mom.
Yeah. There's more in the paper on my website, so go read that. But George was born in the colonies, George Wilkin Romney. And there's a wonderful picture of him. Didn't I include that? There's Gaskell and Anna Amelia. So Gaskell married both Anna and Amelia Pratt, but sequentially. Anna died, and then he married Amy. Okay, there's Carl Heinrich Wilkin and George Wilkin Romney. Okay. Isn't that a wonderful picture? So he's part of this generation that grew up with his father. Gaskell Romney's was the generation. His father, he grew up in a polygamous family, and then he had a monogamous family. It's one of those transition generations. But George was pretty close to that generation, as you can see there. And so both George and Mick have joked about the polygamy and about their polygamous heritage. And more recently, Mick has just kind of not dealt with it at all. And he did a book, kind of an autobiography of himself. I forget the title. But he talks about his ancestors' stay in Mexico. He just emphasizes they were pioneers. They worked hard. They did well. And then they were kicked out of Mexico, and they had to start again in America. He never mentions polygamy, which is the reason for the Mexican colonies.
This is his flip-floppy is that he denies things happened when they did it back, where he changes his position later on.
Well, the Lynn thinks that this is part of Mitt Romney's flip-flopping, and D. Michael Quinn responded to this paper when I gave it previously in Sunstone West. And he was more sympathetic with Mitt Romney. He said, I have very little respect for Mitt Romney, but I'm a little bit more sympathetic with this, the fact that he's not talking about polygamy, because it's very typical of our modern church and our modern culture, is that, you know, unless we happen to be talking about funny things our ancestors did, we don't talk about polygamy. It's just one of those weird things, you know. And again, there's this contrast between 19th century church, which was going by theocratic ethics, was almost a countercultural church, with 20th century church, where we want to be just as ordinary and normal as possible. It's really a fascinating contrast. Yeah. I know everyone here on a first-name basis.
It seems to me that the best quote from Mitt Romney on this whole subject is when he was on the campaign trail and was asked about certain political issues involving marriage. His standard response was, well, it seems to me that marriage has not changed in 5,000 years.
That's a quote from Mitt Romney. He was asked about marriage and said, well, it seems to me that marriage has not changed in 5,000 years. I think that's a standard thing that non-Mormons say, isn't it? You know, he just picked it up and hadn't thought much about his political background. Feel free to jump in here.
Oh, no.
Craig, if you want to. Ron.
Yeah, the issue of mountain justice, I've been thinking about that because, you know, the plural wife is cohabitating and then she gets married civilly, and whereas I get the impulse from her brothers, maybe there's an assumption, I think, that it's the brothers when we don't know that. And so I'm wondering what you think about that, the criticism.
Okay, the question is, what do I think about who might have been involved in the murder?
Is it applicable, the issue of mountain justice in this case?
Yeah, I think it is. Okay. And, you know, I think the Mormons looked at Squire Brassfield as a seducer who deserved death. And there are other cases where people who were looked on as seducers were killed. Sometimes they were Castor.
Yeah, I guess I do have one comment.
Okay, hold on just a second.
Okay, sorry.
But, so, Craig said something interesting. He said it was often someone in the family who felt was called on to. You know, so if we're looking at this killing of Brassfield as a murder, and it's a very interesting in history to come across these murder mysteries, though sometimes you don't get the straight, you know, you don't have the answer. And in this case, you don't. But you could look at someone in the family as someone of interest who carried out the murder, who felt it was their duty.
I was just going to say that, it is ironic. I mean, the marriage to Brassfield was the legal marriage, but in the eyes of the Mormons, the plural marriage would have been the legitimate one, and that was the other one was not the legitimate one. And so that's why I could see, you know, this sense that justice had to be taken. So,
Yes.
Let this be the last one because I've got to set up for our next.
Okay.
I was kind of surprised. Maybe it was in the interest of time. You didn't mention the fact that Charles Buckham was on that original council with John Federighill to keep plural marriage alive, and see that not a year passed without a child being born in polygamy. He and George Buchanan and Bateman and Woolley, that's where our fundamentalist people get the idea that priesthood authority has been passed down. He was one of those that was commissioned to keep plural marriage alive.
The statement is that Wilkin was part, a according to how fundamentalists teach history, and I haven't studied the actual documents behind this, but according to how they teach history, Charles Wilkin was part of a group that was commissioned by John Taylor to keep polygamy alive. And so I haven't studied the documents behind this. I don't know, like this isn't something I specifically studied. So Brian has, so Brian might have a different point of view, who's sitting right there beside
you. Yeah, I thought you had referenced that.
Charles Henry Wilkin was in this inner group of John Taylor. He was a witness to the marriage of John Taylor's last plural wife in 1886, which is, a real interesting act of defiance against the government.
Oh, yeah.
Right during the raid. And so he was definitely in that inner group, and as I say, he was a close friend and bodyguard of George Buchanan, was his adopted son. So I ran across that, I think, in Brian's book. And so maybe I'll put that in a footnote. Thanks for bringing that up.